Today's Tesho will be on case 62 in the Book of Serenity. Case 62 is entitled Me Who's Enlightenment or Not. Bodhidharma's highest truth, Emperor Wu's confusion, Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality, Manjushri's verbal excess. Is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? Case, Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done without falling into the secondary? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who deeply agreed with this. Verse, the secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion. Quickly you should free your hands and relinquish net and trap. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb. Wisdom can hardly know, like you can't bite your own navel. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breezes still. Brought forth, great Yang distinguishes real and false, completely without flaw. The white jade is esteemed. So, again, the whole universe is conspiring to make our sesshin a great success. Last night, we've had incredible thunderstorms, just amazing, and beautiful, inspiring thunder and lightning, heavy rain. You know, rain is, we've gotten a lot of rain, but rain is so beautiful, right? It's just beautiful. In the first decade of my life in Zen, I spent a lot of time practicing in sesshin locations where there was just pouring rain. We used to have a place that we rented for sesshin on Bashan Island, and sometimes it would just, we would all just be sitting in the zendo, and the rain would be drumming on the roof. I think it's so auspicious. It's really like auspicious. The rain and the thunder and lightning helping us practice. It's just really beautiful, and everybody sat so beautifully in the zendo this morning. Everybody's making such a superb effort. It's such a great honor and a pure pleasure to practice with people who are sitting so wholeheartedly. It's really wonderful. You know, this koan is, I think, one of the most important koans. Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? And this is an interesting little story, because Mihu has a monk go over to the temple of another monk to spy, basically, and to see what so-and-so would say. And I imagine that that Yangshan and Mihu are friends, and so they aren't really spying on each other, but they're sort of like testing. Mihu is sort of testing Yangshan to see what he would say. So the monk goes over to Yangshan and says, do people these days need enlightenment or not? And Yangshan said, it is not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling back into the secondary? You know, if you haven't done a lot of Zen, this might not make much sense, this little exchange. But, you know, it's so important to so important to realize that everything we do in Zen is based on trust, you know. And you could say, well, what are we trusting? The truth is that you are already enlightened, that is to say, you already have a fundamentally enlightened nature. Consciousness itself, in its purest form, is just enlightenment. And so, you know, what we're doing is trying to return to that or get back to that. It's like the metaphor that's often used is muddy water and clean water. You know, I've talked about the fact that my teacher Genki Roshi was like a Japanese hillbilly. He did things that you're not supposed to do if you're. Well, first of all, let me just say that in Japan, the precepts are taken very lightly sometimes by some Japanese monks. So it's definitely the case that Japanese monks will drink sake, even though you're not supposed to take, you know, one of the precepts is no intoxicating substances. I've been at many functions in Japanese monastic contexts where it included the serving of sake, and Genki Roshi used to drink sake. And we had a sesshin once where Genki Roshi, who used to make his own sake, brought a jar of basically rice water that was fermenting to the sesshin, and he put it right on the altar next to manjushri. And so, you know, I came to a sesshin, and there was this big glass jar that used to be used in restaurants. If you ever did restaurant work, there used to be these big glass jars with metal tops, screw-off tops, and they were filled with, like, sweet pickles and things like that. And people would, you know, covet these. And I somehow somebody had given Genki Roshi one of these, and it was a big a jar filled with white liquid. So I came to sesshin, and I thought, what is that? You know, this must be some arcane Japanese ritual or something. And Genki Roshi explained that this was rice milk fermenting. And as I would come in each day into the zendo, I would notice that the top of the liquid began to clarify, almost like magic, you know. So the first day was this milky substance, and then the second day there was like a 2 inches of just crystal clear alcohol, actually sake. And each day, would extend another few inches downward. And about 3 days or 4 days into the sesshin, Genki Roshi called attention to the sake. He said, "See, look at this. You're just like the sake," he said. You know, it was true that the jar was gradually purifying itself. And Genki Roshi ended by saying, he said, money can't buy that purity or that goodness or something. And I could see he was just looking forward to having a glass of sake at the end of the sesshin. My second teacher, who taught with Genki Roshi for a long time, Webb Roshi, was really disdainful of this. He really thought this was terrible, and they didn't eventually manage to teach together because they just had such different approaches. But at the time, it just seemed odd to me. But now, in retrospect, I realize Genki Roshi was really showing us something very important. You know, there's a very famous story about a young Zen trainee who was at a temple of a very famous Zen master. And this trainee would sit every spare minute he'd be sitting. And, you know, the other monks would go to take a shower and he'd be sitting. The other monks would, go to bed and he'd be sitting. Basically, he was exemplary in many ways, but he was laboring under a misconception, you know. The teacher at that temple, the Roshi at that temple, one day, while this guy was just sitting, and all the other monks had left the Zendo, the teacher came in and sat next to this monk on the tan, you know. In Chinese monasteries, people sit, in Japanese monasteries too, people don't sit on the floor the way we are. They sit on a platform, little platform, that's about a cushion deep, and there's two platforms on each side of the sitting hall. And the Roshi sat down next to this monk, he had a roof tile. If you've ever seen the clay roof tiles on Chinese monasteries, and it's a matte. It was in this case a matte gray tile. The Chinese gray clay. And he starts polishing it, right? And the student is trying to do a zazen, but the teacher is sitting next to him, and he can feel the tan vibrating, right? And he finally opens his eye, and the teacher is there polishing this gray clay tile. And finally, you know, the students sort of, it's like, well, okay, I'll bite on the hook, you know. He says, what are you doing? And the teacher says, I'm turning this tile into a mirror by polishing it. And the student says, you know, it'll never become a mirror no matter how hard you polish it. And the teacher says basically, well, you'll never become a Buddha by sitting. Now, if you've ever read any books by Alan Watts, which I highly recommend, they're wonderful books on Zen. And he also has these amazing radio broadcasts that get played periodically. And he's an amazing speaker. He speaks in complete paragraphs. He speaks in perfect sentences. They're long, complex. It's like he's able to compose in his head. I am so envious of him. And he's so eloquent that it's difficult sometimes to realize that he doesn't always know what he's talking about. But, you know, he concludes from this story that it's not necessary to do a lot of zazen. I just said this was really showing that the obsession with meditation was misleading. Right? So, you know, basically, if Alan Watts was right, the student would go, oh, okay, and he'd jump down from the tan and leave the monastery and go into the tile business or something. But that's not what happens. You know, he actually continued to practice, but now he could get somewhere. The thing is that everything we do in Zen is about trust, because the fundamental layer of consciousness is enlightenment itself. It's like, if you could get rid of all the impurities in consciousness, you know, you would finally get to this clear, transparent, luminous sake on the altar, You know, and so what we're not doing is working hard to become Buddhas. What we are doing is, you know, working hard to purify body, mind, and heart. And it's like humans have a basic enlightenment, a basic sanity, a basic compassion. You know, I guess any religion produces people who are kind and compassionate, and every religion produces people who are unbelievably brutal and monstrous, right? So, you know, it's very interesting to see how this is true, and I think it's because, you know, basically, sometimes religions do have very negative teachings written into, sewn into their fabric, so to speak. I think it would be hard to find any religion that doesn't have teachings that are appalling, you know, in their lack of humanity. You know, so there are scriptures where God orders people to kill other people. You know, that there are scriptures where it says, you know, in various religions, take up the sword, you know, in my name, and so on. And yet, you know, you can find people in these religions who are just absolutely fantastic people. And I think it's because, you know, in a certain sense, no religion is as good as that your fundamental nature. I guess I would even have to include Buddhism in that, you know. That basically human beings are fundamentally enlightened, and you know, the cultural expressions of that are all a little bit flawed or imperfect. It's like we're still trying to measure up to or give expression to our fundamental enlightenment. And we've created all these myths and we've created all these symbols and rituals. And they can indeed be very helpful, but none of them fully express this truth. You know, fully express our basic humanity. So it's often the case, I would say, that people are better than their religions or better than their cultures. You know, even though we Americans like to take pride in our traditions, you know, our country has done really terrible things. It's not unique in that respect. You know, we definitely have a long history of violence and of racism and so on and so on. And the interesting thing is, you know, that some of our racism and some of our violence is really very democratic. You know, so we value the will of the people, but sometimes the people have made really terrible decisions, you know. Even though I do believe in democracy, even democracy doesn't really manage to capture the absolutely extraordinary character that lies at the heart of consciousness. So I don't think any religion or any culture is fully able to express that. And so, you know, what we have to do when we come to Zen is a process of like deconditioning. You know, it's definitely the case that people in their pursuit of awakening or get blocked in various ways. We all have blockages. You know, there's nobody who is free from those blockages. And you know, when we look at somebody like the Dalai, if you're a Dalai Lama fan, as I am, You know, the Dalai Lama comes to, last time the Dalai Lama came, one of the last times the Dalai Lama came to New York, he spoke in Central Park. And 200,000 people showed up, so he's got a lot of fans. But, you know, and when the Dalai Lama came to Rutgers, he was very affable and funny, and he was in the football field, and, you know, something like 30,000 people showed up to see the Dalai Lama, some of whom said, "Who's the Dalai Lama?" But, you know, the Dalai Lama has had to work really hard to be the Dalai Lama because he's had to decondition himself too, you know. We have all of this baggage that gets in our way, and it's not noticeable, right? It's not something we can be aware of consciously, because our good qualities are intertwined in a very puzzling way with our bad qualities, you know. And it's what looks like a courage could also be aggression. And what looks like a compassion can also be vanity. Yeah. You know, so all of these positives are sort of mixed together like the rice wine on day one. And we're not necessarily in a position to sort it all out. In fact, you know, we really can't sort it all out just using our discriminating intellect. If you have benefited from therapy, you know that you can't be your own therapist, right? You know, you need somebody with an outside perspective to be able to look at your confusion. And you know, you can try, when my wife and I were going through a very difficult period in our marriage, we would sit down and have these long, long involved discussions trying to think through our relationship and get some clarity on our problems. And then we went to this amazing couples therapist. He's amazing. And we went to him for about, I think, 2 years. And it really transformed our marriage because, you know, he could see outside of our assumptions. You know, he could see what we could not see. And in like every session, it was so eye-opening. He was so good at what he did. And there's no way we could have done that on our own. You know, because am I sticking up for my rights? Or am I, trying to dominate the other person? You know, how can you know, right? And it turns out it's not either of those things. It's something else. It's coming from another place. So, having that exterior perspective is enormously liberating. And in Zen, we get that exterior perspective, you could say, in a different way. You know, everybody in this room has a Buddha nature that brought you here. You know, I often say that, you know, something brought you here. Right? Something brought you here. And you can say, you know, I made a decision, I made a conscious choice. Well, that is true, but why did you make this choice? You know, it's definitely the case that we make choices, but you know, in a way, the choices we make are all, we've already made up our minds about what choice we're going to make. You know, there's a philosopher named Sartre. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he says, when we go and seek advice from people, we're always seeking the people who we know will give us the outcome we want. You know, so we don't ask advice from people who will probably give us the answer we don't want. We ask advice from people who will say, "Oh, I think you should do this." You go, "Oh, yes, thank you for that insight." You know, in other words, thank you for giving me permission to do what I want to do. There's a... But the truth is, you know, even when we think we're making a choice, it's already been made for us, you know, in a certain way. There was this fascinating research where people were measuring the brain activity and the body, and they were looking at the way body movements are related to brain function. And they noticed that a strange anomaly was happening where they would wire somebody's head up with electrodes, and then they would say, they also had other kinds of detection devices, and they would say, move your hand when you're ready to move your hand. And what they found was that people were moving their hand before they were ready to move their hand. Already, before they had made the decision to move their hand, they were already moving their hand. And this was so counterintuitive that they did this experiment again and again, and it's been replicated many times, and it makes no sense, right? It's like spooky, right, you know? So before I decide to move my hand, the hand is already in motion. And I would say, even though this is not exactly the conclusion they reach, that, you know, your choices are coming from a deeper place. It's like there's a deeper decision-making process than you're consciously aware of. And it's already made the decision to move, and you sort of get the message last. It's like, if I may say, the big mind decides to move the arm moves, and you say, aha, move, right? Move. And I think coming to Zen is like that too. I think, you know, when I started sitting, I was living in Seattle, and I went to a Tibetan center near the university. And it was typical Tibetan place, right? It was festooned in beautiful colors, and there were prayer flags, and there were more saints, you know, more saints and gods and demons than you could shake a stick at, you know. And the place was loaded with iconography. And, you know, they had these red and yellow cushions. So it was a real circus in there, and I really liked the atmosphere. but there was no resident teacher. It was just open in the afternoons for sitting, and it was a lovely spot, and I had read some books on Zen and on Buddhism. So I would go there and sit. And one day, there was somebody else who was there, and we got to talking, and he said, you know, this Japanese Zen master has come to Seattle, and he's now teaching on Wednesday nights at the university, which is, you know, was right like four blocks from where I was at that moment. So, you know, I made the decision to go and go sit. And then I also, when I met Genki Roshi, when I met Genki Roshi, I instantly became his student. And not everybody who became his student had that relationship to him. But I instantly became his student. And that it doesn't necessarily define everybody's relationship to their teacher, but for him, for me, it was like absolutely okay. And I think what happened was on an unconscious level, you know, I felt very comfortable with this person. And I trusted him 100%. Now, that can get people into trouble, right? There's all kinds of cult leaders and so on. So you should definitely use your critical faculties. But nevertheless, there was something about him that resonated unconsciously with me. And I trusted him implicitly. You know, and I began to do Zen, and you know, my experience of Zen was challenging. I had a lot of physical pain, and you know, I would be, you know, after some sits, I would be covered with sweat, and you know, I've been in this for 40 years. But you know, if I look back on it now, I say, why did I do that? Why did I do that? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, I was going to this thing, and I didn't fully understand it. I would sit down on this cushion, my legs would hurt, and I, by the end of the sitting period, I would be covered with sweat. But I felt so good after sitting. I just felt so good. And I think from a place deep in myself, you know, I was giving myself an instruction, you know, and it was like, take this medicine. And I was taking the medicine. And the medicine at times was a little bitter or a little difficult to swallow. But at the end of it, I felt so much better. And I got better and better. You know, I would say that I got better and better. So, you know, I went to my first sesshin, and it was absolutely unbelievably difficult, you know. And again, I think, why did I go back? You know, why did I go back? You know, because, you know, I had not done much sitting, and I went to this sesshin, and it was just so challenging physically. I don't believe I have had a Zen student who has been totally wrecked by his first sesshin as I was. You know, I remember going into the Dokusan room and just sort of like inching to, you know, it's like, it was hard for me to get down on the cushion. My legs just hurt all the time. And, you know, when I went home after the sesshin, I thought, you know, my thought was, well, that's, you know, I'll never do that again. You know, the day I signed up for the next sesshin. And I mean, it could be that in retrospect, I'm just justifying my decision. But I'm so happy I listened to that voice. And, you know, it's definitely the case that Zen helped me in countless ways, that I was a very closed up person, and it made me, I would like to think, a much more open person. It brought my life to lie, it brought freedom to my life, and it brought my dead life back to the condition of the living, you know. In a few years, I realized I was like, I had the thought, you know, I haven't really been depressed for a long time. So it was just really helping me. And I have had many moments in my practice where, you know, I have sat down and said, why am I doing this? This really doesn't make any sense. I mean, people I knew even tried to warn me off of it. And again, you know, you have to be careful, because there are Svengalis out there who were dangerous people. But, you know, my graduate director, I mentioned, told, he absolutely said, you are wasting your life. And I said, I understand. Well, you know, okay. And then I went out and went to a sit. And I learned a lot from my graduate director. I really respect him, but he didn't know what he was talking about, you know. So, you know, something brought you here, and I think you should listen to that voice. You can be critical too, you know, please be critical. Please think critically about everything that you're told. But you know, more typically than not, we don't listen to that voice enough. You know, we don't trust ourselves enough. You know, I would say 9 times out of 10, that's the biggest obstacle people have in Zen practice, is just not trusting themselves enough. You know, if you practice Zen in a spirit of trust, you know, it becomes a completely different process. If you're trying to achieve results, you know, if you're trying to achieve results, you're going to be trapped by your own lack of trust. You know, if somebody asks you why you're going to a sesshin and you say, well, or make me a better person, blah blah blah, those are all inferior answers. You know, if somebody said, why are you going to sesshin? And you said, you know, the truth is, no, there's no reason, but I'm going. That would be a 100% wonderful answer. Because it would mean that you're just trusting your true nature. You know, trusting. And look, we trust people all the time and get burned, right? It's definitely so. You know, I'm a very trusting person and I have been burned a number of times. This actually happened to me, and you might all want to leave the sesshin after I tell you. I was on my way to a sesshin in the Catskills when I had gotten here to New York. My family is from this area, but is from New York, New Jersey area. But I didn't grow up here, you know. And my wife's uncle lived in Brooklyn, you know, so, you know, we both have connections here, but I didn't grow up in this world. And I was on my way up to a little New York town called Livingston Manor, which is the middle of nowhere. And I hadn't, I didn't actually, when I got to New Jersey, we had one car, so I couldn't drive the car to sesshin, so I had to go into the city and go to the bus, you know, the bus stop, the bus station, and catch what was called the Gray Line up to Livingston Manor. And I was in Penn Station, and I came out looking for a cab, and a very normal-looking guy in what looked like sort of a uniform came up to me and he said, are you looking for a cab? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, oh, you know, there's been an accident and the cabs are rerouted. And he said, it's over here on 8th Avenue now. And there were signs where I was standing that said, cab, you know, this is where the taxis are. And there were no taxis. And he came up and he looked like he didn't have a badge that said Port Authority, but he looked official. And he said, there's been an accident, like a crane accident or something. And he said, the cabs are now operating on 8th. And I said, okay. And he said, I'll take you there. And then this sounds so stupid that you won't believe I did this. But he called me a cab and he said, that'll be $25 for the cab. And I gave him $25 and I got in and when I got to the, the bus station, the guy said, that'll be, you know, $25. I said, I gave it to the other guy. And he said, I don't know that guy. You know, and I thought, how could I be so dumb, you know, to do that? Trust can be, look, was I wrong or not, right? I mean, I lost $25. But I put a value on trust, right? I mean, I trusted somebody who deceived me. And I think from now on, I don't, if anybody did that again, I would say, I know you're, you know, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't fall for that one again. I'd fall for a new one. But I think it's very important to live in trust, even if sometimes you are deceived. It doesn't mean you can't investigate, you know, trust but verify, right? I've read later that there are these scams that go on. They're looking for tourists from Jersey to take advantage of, right? Trust but verify. But I think this mode of trusting is really liberating. You know, even after that happened, I am embarrassed by it. But I'm almost a little how this is going to sound stupid, but I'm almost a little proud of it. Because I trusted somebody I didn't know on the strength of his word. And sometimes I've done that, and it's been very positive, right? And I'm so glad I have cultivated trust in my life, even though I have gotten burned. I could tell you a couple other stories like that one, but I won't. We don't have time today. But I think it's more important to trust other people than not. Even just be vigilant. But if you lose your trusting attitude, it's very destructive for all your human relationships because the suspicion never stops. You know, you'll start looking at your sister, you know, with a squinty eye, like, what's she trying to pull, right? And it immediately arrests it erodes the bonds that bind us together. So, you know, it's ironic that people don't trust themselves, especially the part, you know, something says do this and you say, oh, I can't do that. You know, I can't. And, you know, somebody told me I can't do that. And, you know, sometimes it's very important to do it anyway, right? To do it anyway. So, you know, in Zen there are stories of Zen masters who do things like putting their shoes on their head. And you can say, what's that about? What's the message there? And maybe the message is just trusting your true nature. You know, even if it makes you do something a little silly. So something brought you here, and you know, if you are keeping a scorecard, like you know, I've gone to three sesshins this year, and I've answered 6 koans. You know, that's pretty good. It's a pretty good batting average. Right? You know, if you do that, you're going to ruin your practice. And you will erode your trusting relationship with yourself. You know, I can remember going to sessions and actually being bitterly disappointed after the session ended and I hadn't answered my koan. And it took me a long time to realize that this is the most counterproductive thing I can do. You know, it's just the whole practice of Zen is letting go of expectations, letting go of the inner policeman, and throwing the scorecard out the window, and being open to the possibilities, and then just let it roll, and wherever it takes you is liberating. It's going to be liberating. Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling back into the secondary? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who deeply agreed with this. The secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion, quickly you should free your hands and relinquish net and trap. Get rid of the net, get rid of the trap, the scorecard, etc. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb. Don't worry about winning and losing. Wisdom can hardly know, like you can't bite your own navel. You can't see your own obstacles, but your true nature can, your big mind can. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breeze is chill. Brought forth, great Yang distinguishes real and false, completely without fault. The white jade is esteemed. This is like, you know, a piece of jade can be covered with junk, but inside it's 100% pure jade. It's got all kinds of flaws, right? But inside it's this beautiful pure stone. You're just like that. And actually, you can't get the stones without the flaws, right? And you can't get to the stone without the encountering the flaws. So everybody's doing a wonderful job. Just keep going, trusting your true nature.